Good morning. It's 6 after 10. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of WPR. Kathleen will be back next week. The Wounded Knee Massacre. We've known the facts for more than a century, but the why of this terrible event is still a matter of some discussion. A new book attempts to answer some of the questions surrounding the massacre, and we have its author with us today to talk about it. The book is titled Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre, published by Basic Books and written by Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She joins me by phone. Good morning, Professor, and thank you for being on the program today.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's set the stage for what happened in December of 1890. What was America like politically in the 1880s and leading up to 1890?
If you can think of America in that era, sort of outside the massacre that's going to happen in South Dakota, most people know about it. It's the era of the robber barons, an era when the country was bitterly divided between the very wealthy who ran the industrial economy back primarily in the East, and the workers who worked for them, between the farmers who were not able to make ends meet in the West, and between the employers back East who were doing very well in the new economy. So it was an era in which there was a great division between the very rich and the very poor, between the East and the West, and overwhelmingly between Republicans who were pushing staunchly pro-business legislation at this time, and Democrats who were worried that the government had so fully tied itself to big business.
Well, one of the ironies here, if you think about party politics in the current context, is that the Republicans were actually pushing for high tariffs and the Democrats wanted lower tariffs.
That's right. That's right. It's a reflection of the way people looked at economics in the time, which was really a very primitive science in the 19th century. But in a way, it's a wonderful period to study because economics was so basic in this era, and people were so interested in it. There were newspaper articles everywhere explaining the very basic principles of banking and money and the idea of hard currency versus soft currency and how an economy worked. So for a scholar, it's a great deal of fun to watch a science develop.
Well, and in the 1880s, we weren't all that far removed from the end of the Civil War, and so there were still some regional issues there. You had North. You still had some North-South issues. There was East-West. Talk a little bit about how that plays into the politics of the time.
Well, that's a huge question, of course. But yes, the country is still divided between the North and the South. But the piece of this puzzle that Americans tend to forget if they live east of the Mississippi River is that the overwhelming story of the period from really 1870 on is less about the East, the North, and the South, and much more about the West. If you think about our images of this era, while most of our textbooks talk a great deal about sharecropping and about industrialization and so on, the images that we still have from this era are of the cowboys and the Indians. It's the West that really captures Americans' imagination from about 1870 on. It's the West that gets handed down to us mythically and culturally, and it's really the West that people focus on. But what they're focusing on in America in this late 19th century about the West is the idea that the West is a place where anybody can make it, where the West is not about the government, that there is this image that the government is not involved in the West. That's a complete fantasy. The government is much more involved in the West than it is in any other region of the country, including the South. But there's this fantasy that the West does not have anything to do with the government, and it's a place where everyone can make it. And that grabs hold of Easterners' imaginations, and they really have this vision of the West as this great place where anybody can make it. And when that doesn't happen, they look for somebody to blame.
And who were they blaming?
Well, by the 1890s, they're blaming railroad men and the government because the railroad men, what happens is after the Civil War, again, we all tend to say, oh, the war ends in 1865, and in fact, that war does, but the U.S. government is still at war with Plains Indians. We talk a lot nowadays about the 14th Amendment, and the 14th Amendment is very much in the news, but one of the things that people don't talk about a lot with the 14th Amendment is it does exclude Indians, not taxed, and the reason for that is because Indians were at war, certain of the Indian tribes were at war with the U.S. government, and if they were made citizens, it was legal to sell them guns. So when Congress decides not to put Indians not taxed into the 14th Amendment, it's because they don't want them to be able to legally buy guns because they are at war with the U.S. government. So what happens is that the Easterners focus on the West with the idea that they're going to go out there, they're going to make a fortune, and they hope that the government is going to protect them from Indians. And at the same time, the government gives a lot of land to the railroads to enable them to raise money, to sell that land, to raise money, and to be able to fund the construction of the railroads. And all this sounds like a lovely thought, except the railroads, in order to sell their land for the highest prices, advertise it back east as paradise. Well, anybody who now thinks of North Dakota and South Dakota and Wyoming and Idaho and Nebraska and Kansas recognizes that you are not going to make a living as a farmer in those regions without one heck of a lot of hard work, but also without modern irrigation systems, which don't really take off until the turn of the century, really. So they sell this vision of the West as a place where anyone can make it, where it's a great paradise, where all you have to do is basically move out there and you're going to have a three-story home and a parlor piano and everyone's going to be happy and jolly, when in fact settlers get out there and they discover not only is it incredibly hard work and incredibly poor conditions, many of them are living in dugouts or soddy houses without neighbors, with terrible storms and extremes of temperature. Not only is it a hard existence, they are in hock to the railroads to get all their produce back east to sell it. So they become aware that they are dependent on the railroads, and the railroads are charging especially small farmers much higher prices than they charge big business, and the railroads quickly come to exercise real undue influence in Congress. And not only the railroads, but the manufacturers who make the goods for the railroads, the steel, the rolling stock, all that, begin to exercise a great deal of power in Congress. And Westerners especially resent this, and they resent the connections between the government and big business. Westerners resent it, and so do Eastern laborers, who are also at the mercy of the similar problem that their employers exercise a great deal of government power when they don't, and when they are actually quite badly hurt by some of the legislation that promotes big business. So by the 1890s, you have on the one hand an economy that appears to be booming, that's doing a lot of good for industrialists, for railroad men, for big business, but at the same time you have a growing and a roiling population of Americans who resent the connection between the government and big business and who believe that America is truly being destroyed by the connection between big business and government.
Well, I don't want to go down a rabbit trail here because I want to get us to a wounded knee and how all this plays into that. But it struck me as very ironic that Benjamin Harrison, who took office in 1890, who won the electoral vote but not the popular vote, came in with a surplus in the Treasury, and by the time he got out of office, there was an economic collapse and the surplus was gone. The irony of that and history repeating itself more than 100 years later was not lost on me.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, what I like to say to people, many of my students come to me and they say, oh, well, this is exactly what happened in the past. And I say, no. Humans are unique. There is no one-to-one correspondence between the past and the present. What historians do, though, is we study how society works, almost as if we're scientists of the way people react in certain situations. And there is no doubt in my mind that if you put similar people into similar situations, often they react in exactly the same ways or very similar ways. Somebody once said to me, you know, well, what you're saying about wounded knee, well, it could have happened under anyone. And I said, no. It simply would not have happened under Grover Cleveland, who had very different imperatives, very different ideas. This had to happen under Benjamin Harrison. It would not have happened under Grant. It would not have happened under Garfield. It would not have happened under any of those late 19th century presidents. We all forget it had to happen under Benjamin Harrison because of his bizarre political imperative.
Well, let's talk about Benjamin Harrison. What kind of politician was he?
Well, to my mind, a very sad politician. He was a very pious man who believed that God had put him in the presidency, despite the fact that he had lost by 100,000 votes. He had lost the election to Grover Cleveland. And he was sort of bewildered all the time. He was handled by a group that I call, only partly jokingly, a cabal, a group of advisors who really control what he does. And he's sort of a very sad character in my mind, and yet not a sympathetic one, in that he is so convinced that he must promote big business that he does. He's extraordinarily corrupt. His administration is extraordinarily corrupt, and they do a number of things that we still live with today. So I, as a person, I found him very sad, but as a president, I think he should go down in history as one of our worst presidents. And the fact he's been forgotten seems to me to be much too nice to him.
Well, what were the things that he did that we're still living with?
Well, this to me was one of the most interesting things about the Wounded Knee book. You know, we don't tend to think a lot about the admission of states to the Union. They just sort of come in. At least that's the way I always looked at it. But in fact, in 1889 and 1890, the Harrison administration admits six new states to the Union. They are six states that do not have a very large population. In fact, they have quite a small population. But the Harrison administration admits them because they believe that those states will vote Republican. And this is important for two reasons. It's important, first of all, because they have such a small population, they barely can muster one member of the House of Representatives. But each state will send two senators to the Senate. What this means is that the Senate, by packing it with 12 new Republican senators, should remain a Republican stronghold, and they argue in perpetuity. They want it to make the Senate Republican forever so it can stop legislation that might break the ties between government and big business. This is a huge deal. This is what gets us North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and the state of Washington. Now, if you listen to those states, you will see that the complaints that people made in the late 19th century about the sudden admission of these six states are ones you could still make today. And that's that they have such a low population that their senators exercise way more power per capita than senators from states like New York, which was the complaint at the time. And even moderate Republicans who were not Harrison fans in the 19th century, in 1889 and 1890, complained bitterly at the overturning of the concept of Republican government, that when you started letting in states just so that you could pack your own party into a member, into one of the houses of Congress, then you were undercutting Republican government. And the fact that we sort of don't think about how those states came into the Union seems to me to be a big problem, because they still do exercise a huge amount of influence in our Senate.
There, we are talking about the book Wounded Knee, how party politics and the road to American massacre, by Heather Cox Richardson. She's my guest this hour. You can join us by phone if you'd like to at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the phone number to call. You can also send an email to the program. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And we have there's a Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. You can go there, leave a comment, and we'll share it here as well. Again, the book is Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. We'll have more with our guest in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of WPR. It's coming up on 21 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Here's what's coming up later on today. The proposed mosque near Ground Zero is just the latest example of tensions between Muslims and many other Americans. After one on Talk of the Nation, the meaning and misunderstandings of mosques. That's coming up later today on the Ideas Network. This hour, the discussion centers on the book Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre by Heather Cox Richardson, who joins me by phone. And you can, too, at 800-642-1234. So we had a very partisan atmosphere in the United States at this time. After the Civil War, Americans wanted to spread their new economy across the country. This economy that they were spreading into the West didn't blend very well with the traditional culture that was already there.
No, that's for sure. The Plains Indians had, of course, been in on the plains for generation after generation after generation, and they had subtly altered the land and the animals on the land so that they were terrific for grazing animals like the bison. The problem was that bison and grazing animals need a lot of land in order to multiply and in order to keep their population numbers up. And the railroads and the settlers and the miners who came through the plains wanted to use the land in a very different way. And these two ways of looking at the land and at resources were completely incompatible. Sort of interesting to think about what we might have achieved had we not considered them incompatible, if in fact people had been able to think about them and compromise. But because they were unable to do that, it meant there was going to have to be a showdown between the two.
What was the popular view of the Plains Indian at the time?
Well, the time was a long time, of course, so that changes a bit. But after the Civil War, as I said briefly before, the U.S. government is at war with a number of Plains tribes. Now, those run down. These are the tribes that most people know from movies, for example. They became very very famous as sort of stock characters, as evil savages in movies, although that it completely washed over the fact they're very different tribes with very different histories and all that. But the U.S. Army is at war from the southwest with the Comanches up to the area in which this book is concerned, with in the northwest with the Sioux. And the image of them is that they are implacable enemies of America. And the reason for that is not just the ongoing warfare. I mean, these are tremendously effective fighters. Unlike the Eastern Indians that Americans were able to overcome fairly easily, the Western Plains Indians had horses, and they were terrific fighters. So they're really, really good fighters. They beat the U.S. government again and again and again. And in fact, in 1868, the Sioux pretty much win against the U.S. government. But also there is this sense coming out of the Civil War, especially among the Northerners, but also among Southerners, that they had just fought this devastating war to make America a certain kind of land, to give it an economy where any man could rise so long as he worked hard. And this, they firmly believed, was the pinnacle of human achievement. And the idea that a bunch of guys on horses would try and stand in the way of this was not only objectionable, it was to them outrageous. So the Indians, especially the Sioux, and I mean the Comanche are a different story that I know, but for this case, we'll talk about the Sioux. The Sioux get this image of being backward and hostile, but not just enemies, sort of an enemy to the very fundamental being of what it means to be an American. And the leaders of the Sioux in this period are two, there are a number of them, but the two ones whose careers will play out in the 1890s are Red Cloud, who was probably the most famous Indian in the 19th century, and I find it astonishing that he is not well known today. Every single American would have known who Red Cloud was from the 1860s to the 1890s. Even newly arrived immigrants would have known who Red Cloud was Red Cloud, and also Sitting Bull. And, of course, Sitting Bull has come down in history, so most people know that name. But both of them were leaders of the Sioux against the U.S. Army, and they became the symbol of Indian resistance to the American government, to the American Army, and also to the American way of life. And they were hated because of that.
And they became the demons. They became everybody's boogeyman, I suppose.
Well, they did, except for the fact that what happens, and this is a story that the most Americans know pretty well even today, although they seldom connect the dots. What happens is after the Civil War, the Sioux are at war. You really can't talk about them as one entity, but many bands of the Sioux are at war with the U.S. government, and they fight quite successfully against the government from 1866 to 1868 in a series of battles that becomes known as Red Cloud's War. In 1868, the U.S. government finally says enough is enough, and in a commission that's actually led by William Tecumseh Sherman, who goes from fighting the South to fighting the Plains Indian Wars in 1865, he leads this commission, and they finally say, okay, we can't protect the railroads any longer and protect the Bozeman Trail, which goes up through the Sioux country. We've got to give up on one of them. The railroads are more important to us. Let's give up on the Bozeman Trail, and they sign a treaty with the Sioux, the Treaty of Fort Laramie, Which essentially Red Cloud interprets as him winning. The U.S. Army pulls out of the Bozeman Trail region, out of the Sioux region, and the Sioux burn three U.S. Army forts. What happens then, though, is that the Americans are supposed to stay out of Sioux territory, and they don't. They absolutely don't. They go in partly to settle, but mostly to see if there's gold in the Black Hills and also in Montana, which is they've discovered a lot of gold in Montana in the 1860s. What happens then is that as more and more settlers come through, Red Cloud goes, or miners come through, Red Cloud goes back to Washington. You forget that there's a lot of going between Washington and the West in this period. He actually takes a delegation to Washington, and he says, listen, I got a treaty here that says you guys are going to stay out of my land. Get out. And the U.S. Army sort of tentatively tries to for a while, and then they finally give up, and they say, you know what? We can't keep settlers out of this land. Settlers should just go and fight the Indians. Go ahead, go into this land, but take a gun with you. So what happens is there is sporadic fighting by the early 1870s between miners and settlers and the Indians. And then in 1875, George Armstrong Custer goes in, and he goes in under orders from his commanding officer to see if putting a new fort in that region is going to stop the Indian warfare. In fact, Custer is much more interested in gold, and he goes to the Black Hills and he says, guess what, guys? There is gold here. What this does is it creates a stampede into Sioux land, and while Red Cloud at that point is living near an agency, Sitting Bull steps in and he says, no, this is our land. It is my land. We are not going to have Americans on this land. Sitting Bull pulls together a coalition of a number of tribes, but primarily of Sioux, and they band together to fight against the U.S. Army. The Army marches in to conquer them in the summer of 1876, and that's when you get the Battle of the Little Bighorn. After the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which is a disaster for the U.S. Army, as most people know, Custer's command gets wiped out. Not everybody, incidentally, dies at that battle, but Custer's command gets wiped out. The U.S. Army chases down the various coalition partners that Sitting Bull has pulled together, and by 1877... most of them have surrendered. Sitting Bull has run to Canada, but most of them have surrendered. By 1878, they have all been forced onto what is known as the Great Sioux Reservation, which is essentially the western half of South Dakota, west of the Mississippi River. So even though they have this reputation as being terrifically warlike, by 1878, they are virtually all living on a reservation. And once they're living on a reservation, there are no more military issues with the Sioux from 1878 to 1890. So there is a sense back east that, yes, they were savages and all that and all the derogatory things they say, but by 1878, by the 1880s, they are being, and this should be in quotation marks, civilized. They're going to school. They're living on reservations. They're wearing white clothes. This is a story of great success. The Sioux are, even the Sioux, they say, are buying into American culture, are buying into the American economy. This just shows how terrific the American system really is. So that while they were seen as savages, by the 1880s, they are seen as a great triumph for American society, with the exception of a few holdouts like Sitting Bull, who has run to Canada, and like the few hundred people who follow him.
We have full phone lines. A lot of people would like to ask questions or make a comment on this issue. And let's start. We'll go to Nina first and talk to Robert. Robert, good morning. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for holding.
Oh, thank you. Hello, Heather.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
I've been actually on the Bozeman Trail and been to Fort Fetterman.
Uh-huh.
And I comment simply is that Wounded Knee was kind of like the end of Manifest Destiny. That was the end of the Indian uprising.
It certainly was, although I suspect that a number of Asian nations would say that it was not the end of Manifest Destiny. Maybe the end of Manifest Destiny on this continent. But you're right, it's sort of the punctuation mark at the end of the American war against Native Americans, at least in the lower 48.
But was there actually an uprising going on? I mean, that's one of the questions that comes up later. There wasn't any real uprising at this point, was there?
No, there was not. What happens is, and I say that really definitively, there really was not. I mean, believe me, I've been through all the Army records, all the government records, all the Indian records. There is no complaint about the Indians, fear of an uprising, no letters to Congress, no letters to governors, no letters to the president, no editorials in newspapers until after the troops already go into South Dakota. And the story of why they go into South Dakota is a story all about the Harris administration and control of Congress, not about the Indians. Nonetheless, though, Robert is right that Americans saw the Wounded Knee, the events at Wounded Knee, as the final triumph over the Sioux. They really rewrote what happened there to make it, as I say, the punctuation mark at the end of taking over the continent.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Let's go to Viola next and take a call from Eugene.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can, Eugene.
Yes, I can.
Good. I'm on a cell phone. I taught out at Manderson School District about 25 years ago. I was teaching seventh and eighth grade, and I got along pretty good, pretty much. It's a little bit of a dangerous situation. You didn't go out wandering at night.
Mm-hmm.
You never knew which kind of a drunk would jump you. But as far as Little Bighorn is concerned and Wounded Knee, the troops that survived with Captain Benteen and Major Reno, some of those, the 7th Cavalry was at Wounded Knee, and some of those guys were just out for revenge.
That's absolutely right. What happens is they rebuild the 7th Cavalry after the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and there are some that are definitely out for revenge, and a lot of them are new as well. But yes, after the shooting events at Wounded Knee, or after the shooting happened, a number of people said, "We have finally gotten revenge for the Battle of the Little Bighorn."
Eugene, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Rick in Prentice.
Oh, hello. I love all this history, but from what I've read about the incident, I have a much more elegant description of it. It won't take long. The Indians in question had, it was known to the military, they had just received a rather large shipment of brand-new Winchester rifles. My guess is it would have been probably the model 1886, which was a big rifle with big cartridges for hunting buffalo, and it held 10 rounds in the gun. It was a very accurate, very long-range gun. And when the cavalry heard about that, they were just absolutely paranoid. And so they went there to disarm the Indians. They were so paranoid, they brought artillery. And they put the artillery on a rise overlooking the village, and then they went down with a smaller group to disarm the Indians, and the local chief had one of these rifles in his arms, holding it tight like a baby, and I believe he was deaf, and the military commander ordered him to surrender the rifle, and apparently he didn't hear. And the military commander misinterpreted that, and he yanked the rifle out of the chief's hands, and when he did, it went off. And when the artillerymen heard that, they could not actually see what had happened, but they thought they were under fire, so they opened up with cannon, and they blew the whole village to pieces.
Well, you know, Rick, you're about where I went into this project thinking, of course they were a military threat. They're some of the most powerful fighters in the country. And a lot of what you say is exactly what happened, although some of the characters are a little bit different. But in fact, that idea of the shipment of guns, that was a rumor that came down. And what happens is the Harris administration is desperate. The states I talked about that come into the Union and were supposed to be Republican, in fact, the conditions in the West are so bad in the 1890s that most of those states begin to slide over to the populists and the Democrats, or rather their alliance members then. They're not quite the populists, but they start to slide to the Democrats. The Harris administration gets panicked that it's not going to be able to hold them, and if it doesn't hold them, it knows in the midterm elections of 1890 that they're going to take losses. A president always takes losses in a midterm election, and they know they're not going to be an exception. But what they do is they double down on this major pro-business law, and they believe that it's going to bring more people to them, and instead they lose control of the House of Representatives by 2-1. Now, before that happens, or when they pass that law, they know they've got to hold on to South Dakota, which is the one that's looking the worst, sliding toward the Democrats. And in fact, they replace Indian agents in the Great Sioux Reservation, which has actually been divided. It's six new reservations by then. They replaced the seasoned guys who know what they're doing with political operatives who have instructions just to hand out contracts to get as many Republican voters as they can. The problem is that two of those guys, I mean, there's many problems with that, but two of those guys don't know anything about Indians, and they are terrified. And from the minute, and one of them is going to be diagnosed as a drug addict within 5 years, but his stuff is really erratic even in this in 1890, so he may already be a drug addict. They start to write these letters saying, oh, my God, I've heard this rumor here. I've heard this here. I've heard this going on here. I've heard this. The problem is that everybody around them, the army officers and all the settlers, keep saying, you guys are bonkers. There's nothing going on here. There is not a problem here. But they get really fixated on Winchesters, which are beautiful guns, I have to say. They're really the top-of-the-line guns. You're dead right about that. And believe that the Indians are going to use them to kill settlers. In fact, it's quite likely, because they have so severely cut the Indian rations, that the Indians really do want to hunt. Because if they don't hunt, they're going to die in the winter. The winter's coming, and they have no food. But that becomes that argument that they are going to, that there's this huge cache of weapons. Actually, for a while, people argue that Sitting Bull is sitting on this huge cache of weapons. In fact, there is no evidence for that at all, except these two agents and even the head of the army, Nelson Miles. He reports that initially, and you can see it if you're interested. This is actually on Google Books now. The Secretary of War's report from 1891 has an entire section on Wounded Knee and all the telegrams. And Miles says, in fact, there's this cache of weapons, and they're going to be coming down from the north with it. But then 3 days later, he says that's completely a rumor. It didn't happen. And he balls out one of his underlings for believing the rumor, even though he himself was the one who spread it. So, in fact, that's one of the pieces of misinformation that then the Harris administration tries to revive after the events at Wounded Knee, but that, in fact, were really not true even at the time. They were a function of these two frightened Indian agents. But the rest of it, the surrounding of the guns, it wasn't a village. It was actually a bunch of surrendering Indians on the hills, and the struggle over the gun. That was not a chief who was struggling over the gun. And the man actually says, I pay a lot of money for this Winchester. You know, these were top-of-the-line guns. I'm not going to hand it over unless you pay me for it, because the guys who were taking the guns were actually writing their names on them so they could take them home, and they actually take a bunch of the guns. It's sort of like saying, you know, this is my BMW. You're not going to just walk off with it unless you pay me something for it. And later on, someone said he was deaf, although he did have a sense of what was going on around him. And there was a struggle over the gun. It did go off. And at that point, it was not the artillery that opened fire, actually. It was the men standing in a circle. The commander had actually arranged his troops in a circle, which is astonishing. But the commander of the army at that point was a desk sergeant for the most part, a desk colonel, and he screamed, fire, fire at them. And when that happened, the infantry starts firing, and then the artillery hears the guns. They're a bit out of ear reach, and they start to fire down on the wagons. So they do end up killing about 270 of the 300 people who had surrendered the night before. But anyway, Rick, thank you very much for that. You know an awful lot more than most Americans do about this tragedy.
Rick, thanks for the call. We're talking about the book Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre, with the author of that book, Heather Cox Richardson. And, Professor, when we come back, I want to talk about how the politics of fear created this whole mess. That's one of the main premises of your book, and I want to talk about that in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. It's about 10:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Coming up next, Larry Mueller is in after 11. Personal money management is one of the topics for Larry Mueller after 11. His guest is Connie Kilmark of Madison, founder of Kilmark and Associates. That's coming up after 11 o'clock this morning here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking with Heather Cox Richardson, author of Wounded Knee, Party Politics, and the Road to an American Massacre. And, Professor, you started to really allude to how the politics of the day, the party politics, the heavily partisan atmosphere, and the political maneuvering produced the situation in South Dakota that led to the Wounded Knee Massacre. I would like you to specifically talk about the politics of fear that was being used by the powerful elites of that day.
One of the things that's really important to remember about the 1890s, and when you go into this, as a historian, but also just somebody who's interested in American society, is that both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, really, truly, honestly believed that their opponents were trying to destroy America. The Democrats believed that the tying of the government to big business was destroying the opportunities for hardworking men to rise, which was the heart of American society. The Republicans, on the other hand, firmly believed that anybody who wanted to address the tenement problems in New York or the working conditions that left people without arms and legs or any of that, anybody who wanted to regulate government was a communist or a socialist. Those words do not come into our lexicon in the 20th century. They come in the late 19th century. So anybody who wants to break the ties of government to big business, they insist is a communist or a socialist who is going to destroy America, and they really, really believe that. Some people just mouth it, but they really believe that if their party doesn't win, the world is going to end. Not only is America going to be destroyed, America as a beacon of hope for all society is going to be destroyed. The Republicans believe that if the Democrats win, and they know that the Democrats have the votes, they know that the Democrats are the more popular party, they know that legislation regulating business is popular, that that people want there to be, not to be price gouging and all the things that monopolies are able to do in the late 19th century. They know that the Democrats have the votes, but they are also convinced that if they let the democratic system take its course, and they let Democrats become run the government, that the country is going to end. And there's a sense of crisis in this period that I think, you know, we tend to say, oh, yeah, those old guys sitting around in their fancy, you know, homes, they don't, you know, are working in the fields, you know, they're just getting through their days. No, they really believe that the world depends on them. So what happens is, as I say, the Republicans continue to pass big business legislation, and the Democrats continue to hammer on the idea that monopolies, big business, the Republican ties to big business, the fact that big businessmen fill the war chests of the Republicans so they can get reelected and all that, they keep on hammering on how bad that is for the country, that it's going to destroy the country. And they're making huge inroads. By the midterm elections of 1890, it is clear that the Republicans are going to take a bad hit, that the Democrats are going to do very well. But it's not clear, as I say, how well they're going to do. What happens then is that the crisis on the Sioux reservations becomes part of the national conversation. The Democrats look at the fact that the Sioux on the Great Sioux Reservation, I'm sorry, on their six reservations have gotten a terrible hand from the Harris administration. First, the Harris administration forces them to give up most of their land, the Great Sioux Reservation, and forces them onto six small reservations that don't have enough food for them. Then, immediately on the heels of that, within a month, it slashes their rations, so they are literally starving. When that happens, the Republicans say, we're doing them a favor because really they just need to work harder. And this is going to teach them to work harder. But by the fall of 1890, when this is the Alliance summer of 1890, when people are starving all over Oklahoma and Kansas and into the Dakotas because there's such a drought on the plains, you can't raise a crop. Even the native hay crop dies. When that happens, the Democrats back east say, look at what the Republicans have done. We've told you that all they care about is big business, and that's clear in the Dakotas because they took all the Indian land to give it to the railroads and to settlers, which is pretty much what they did. And instead of actually taking care of the Indians the way they're supposed to by treaty, they have put agents in who only want the Indian contract so they can spread them out to get more Republican votes. And what this has done is it's put the Indians back on the warpath, and they're going to slaughter settlers because the Indians by then had turned to a religious movement. It was a peaceful religious movement, but it was a religious movement that was supposed to bring back their ancestors and food and game. And so the Democrats say, look, this just proves that these guys are only out for big business, and they're even willing to sacrifice settlers out west, these heroic settlers, to the hands of bloodthirsty Indians in order to help out the railroads. Well, the Republicans then counter with, oh, no, 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 there's no problem out here. that isn't the fault of the Indians. We're actually being really good to the Indians. We're trying to make them join our economy by cutting down their food and all that, and forcing them into an American way of life. Those who are joining the ghost dance and who are dancing and who are wanting the old world back, they're just savages, and they can't ever be civilized, as they say. These are all their words, not mine. So what happens is the problems in what is now South Dakota become part of the politics back east, and they become fought in very distinct Republican-Democratic terms back east. And as trouble then escalates in South Dakota, they continue to be seen that way. What happens then in the fall of 1890 is you've got these agents I talked about who don't know what they're doing. The agents keep saying, we're desperate for troops, we're desperate for troops. And the people in the government back east say, well, you two might be, but we haven't heard a peep from anyone. And that is literally true. There just hasn't been any complaints in the newspapers or anything. And actually, if anybody's interested, I can point you toward newspaper articles that are easily available that don't talk about that being as a problem in South Dakota. But the army officers out there and everybody else says, listen, we simply don't have a problem. What happens though is that as the agents keep begging for troops and the Harrison administration gets more and more nervous about what might be happening in South Dakota, what happens is the midterm election of 1890 happens, and when it does, the Republicans realize they're in much deeper manure than they thought they were. They lose the House of Representatives by a margin of 2-1, but they say, well, that's okay, we got all these new senators, we're cool, except they're not. They only hold the Senate by 4 votes. And 3 of those votes are Westerners who voted against the Harrison administration on the last important vote. That means that the Republicans can hang on to their pro-business legislation only if they maintain control of that one last Senate seat. And you guessed it, that one last Senate seat is from South Dakota. There isn't a direct election of senators in this period. It's the legislature that elects them, and they are not going to make a decision until January of 1891. And the election is contested. There has been widespread fraud across South Dakota. So what happens is the election is November 4th. In mid-November of 1890, the Harrison administration, on the basis of these two hysterical agents and against the advice of the Army, sends the troops. A third of the U.S. Army, the largest mobilization since the Civil War, sends them into South Dakota. And from then, everything snowballs. So that's how the politics of fear goes into the politics of controlling government to create the situation that's going to lead to a massacre in December of 1890.
Wow, it's a fascinating story and very tragic. Let's go to La Crosse next, and we'll hear from Scott. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. As a undergraduate studying out west, I remember taking a Colorado history course, and where we were taught how things were just reversed in as far as press coverage went, such as when a trading family was killed in a battle with the local tribe. It was known as the Meeker Massacre, and yet when the cavalry surrounded a village of children, elderly, and women, and basically slaughtered them all, it was the Battle of Sand Creek. And my question is, at this late in the Indian Wars, what was the press coverage of Wounded Knee? Did they list it as a battle, or were they at that point well informed enough to call it what it really was?
Scott, that is a great point, and you see that not only in the West, but also in coverage of the battles in Reconstruction. And I think you can also, if you look at coverage nowadays of international crises, you see the same thing, that depending on who is the aggressor and who is the victim, the language is very different, and that's really important. The coverage of what happens at Wounded Knee on the morning of December 29th, when, as I say, about 270, mostly women and children and unarmed men are killed by the Army, what happens is, again, it divides along very strict partisan lines. The Democrats, both in those in Congress and the newspapers, had been saying since late November, if you send the troops in here, you're going to get a massacre, and that's exactly what the Republicans want, because Americans love it when the army does something spectacular, and the Republicans are just going to take all, they desperately want Indian land, and they're just going to take it all. That's exactly what's going to happen. One Democrat stands up on the floor of Congress and says, blood is going to be spilled, mothers are going to be crying, babies are going to die, and it is going to be on your head. And that's exactly what the Democrats argue after the massacre. On the Republican side, though, the Republicans, both in Congress and in the newspapers, say, this is great. These people were hostile. They were dangerous. They were on the warpath, none of which is true. They even say, actually, that Sitting Bull and Red Cloud are behind this. These guys are both in their 70s, and Red Cloud is blind. He can't even walk across his own yard without being led by the hand, and the idea that he's at the head of an army is just nuts. But the Republicans say, these are savages. We have finally cleared the way for Western development, and the U.S. soldiers are heroes. Now, the army officer over the commander who led the troops to Wounded Knee, he actually was so horrified by what had happened, he ordered a committee of inquiry, and he determined that that it was a massacre, that the guy should be court-martialed, he should be convicted, he should be put in prison. This was a stain on the U.S. military. And he was completely overruled by the politicians in the War Department and at the Interior Department, who insisted that, in fact, this was great heroism. And their version of the story won, in part because Harrison is still in office, of course, in 1890. And in the summer of 1890, Harrison begins to give out medals of honor. They're not congressional medals of honor at the time. They're medals of honor. And he gives them to soldiers from a number of wars. You could basically get one by asking for one in this era. It's not till the 20th century that begins to have quite high standards. But he gives out medals of honor and makes a big deal of giving medals of honor to a number of soldiers, including 20 of them who had been at Wounded Knee and who had quite clearly turned the artillery on unarmed men and women and children. And that image of the American soldiers as great heroes against savages becomes the story that gets handed down in America until really Angie Debo's books in the 1940s, which were largely ignored, but especially Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee in 1970, which is why that book became so important. So, yeah, there is a political division, but there is what wins is the idea of the U.S. Army as heroes, even though Army officers themselves say, oh, my God, we have just presided over a massacre.
Scott, thanks for that. Thanks for that insightful comment. And let's go to Mount Horeb next and hear what Phil has to say. Phil, good morning.
Good morning. You, since I placed my call, have covered some of the issues of the politics of the East versus the West, and the Democrats versus the Republicans. And so I wanted to ask, what was the influence, perhaps, of people who are beginning to regard the American Indian as a noble person, a person who had rights, a person who lived in harmony with the land, a person who had the capability to be independent and self-sustaining if they were only allowed to be so. And also I'd like to ask you if we've learned anything in terms of the three words that I think Americans need to define most, which are xenophobia, jingoism, and plutocracy.
Wow, that's a lot to chew on, and we only have about a minute and a half to do it, Professor.
Well, let me just say, this is why I love doing stuff in the Midwest. You guys are so well-informed, and you have such great questions. In fact, Phil, that's sort of it's a great note to end on, because that's sort of the point of my book, is that there were a number of people who, in fact, thought very well of the Sioux, who believed staunchly in Indian reform, who wanted to give them space to make their own futures. And yet those are the same people, for the most part, who support the Harris administration. And they divorce their ideas about Indians from what the Harris administration is doing economically. And part of the point of this book was to say, you can't do that, that Americans can't walk away from what their government does. If you support a government, if you support hysterical language, which is what the Harrison administration used, if you support the use of slurs on other people to whip up fear, if you support using individuals like the Indians as boogeymen in order to get voters, And if you are a person who supports that kind of politics in America, you are just as responsible for things like the Wounded Knee Massacre as the poor soldier out there stuck in the snow in South Dakota in 1890 who happens to pull the trigger. So, yes, there are reformers. Yes, they are horrified by what happens. And, yes, they tend to vote Republican. So so that's sort of the point of what this all was all about, is have we learned? My next book suggests that perhaps not, but that I hope that one of the things the Wounded Knee book does is it convinces people to look more fully at the kind of politics that Americans engage in and are engaged in today, and to recognize that this sort of language, this sort of boogeyman, this sort of hysterical belief that only one party is right leads to tragedy, and that we all own that tragedy if we permit that sort of politics.
And that's where we'll have to leave it. Thank you so much, Professor Richardson, for joining us this hour.
Thank you, John.
Heather Cox Richardson is professor at the Department of History at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Dave Potratz handled on-air production. Thanks to them for all their hard work, and Chrissy Pease as well the last couple of weeks. Kathleen will be back next week. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.